Jazz is Ed, by Arthur Whitfield Cavendish. Narrator, Leo Sloan. Olagaldzu. The morning after the war, at 11:00 p.m. on November 11, 1918, the guns on the Western Front fell silent after 4 years and 3 months of industrial slaughter. In Times Square, New York City, the news had arrived hours earlier, carried by telegraph wire and newspaper extra, and by nightfall, the streets were impassable. Confetti rained from office windows, strangers embraced on Broadway, women kissed soldiers in uniform. The crowd sang "Over There," and the Star-Spangled Banner and songs too bawdy to print. Factory whistles blew all night across the boroughs. The noise was said to be audible from 10 miles out at sea. The celebration was genuine, and it was also deeply confused. America had entered the war only in April 1917, 18 months before the armistice. And the country's relationship to the conflict had never been uncomplicated. Woodrow Wilson had won re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." The war he finally asked Congress to declare was, in his framing, a war to make the world safe for democracy. A crusade that would end militarism and imperial competition forever and replace them with a League of Nations governed by law. The people cheering in Times Square that November night believed, or wanted to believe, that the sacrifice had been worth it. The numbers suggested the scale of what had ended. More than 16,000 Americans had died in the war, most of them from influenza rather than combat. The global death toll was approximately 20 million military dead, with another 50 million killed by the influenza pandemic that swept the world in 1918-1919. A catastrophe so vast that no political system could entirely account for it. Europe was physically devastated. France had lost 1.4 million men. Britain had lost 888,000. Germany had lost 2 million. The Austro-Hungarian, Ottoman, and Russian empires had all collapsed. The United States had emerged from the war as the world's dominant economic power. American banks had financed the Allied war effort. American industry had outproduced every European nation. American agriculture had fed a continent. The country that entered the war as a but secondary power exited it as the essential nation, the one without whose participation the old European order could not have survived. This was a new and uncomfortable position for a country whose founding ideology emphasized separation from European entanglements. What did a world power do with its power? Wilson had an answer. It joined the League and led by moral example. The Senate had a different answer. It rejected the League of Nations in November 1919 and again in March 1920. So the decade that opened in Times Square with that frenzied celebration would be defined by a single large contradiction. America had the power to reshape the world and chose emphatically not to. It turned inward instead, to prosperity and pleasure and the settling of old scores, to the automobile and the radio and the moving picture, to jazz and bootleg gin in the stock market, to the Ku Klux Klan and the immigration restriction laws and the Scopes trial. The energy that might have gone outward went inward, and what it produced was at once brilliant and ugly, creative and fearful, free and violently repressive. The decade that followed that November night would be called, later, and with some nostalgia, the Roaring Twenties. The roar was real. So was the silence underneath it. The New America, 1919-1924. Chapter 1. The Red Summer, Race Violence and the Great Migration. Between 1910 and 1920, approximately 500,000 black Americans left the South for northern industrial cities. They departed Mississippi and Alabama, Georgia and Louisiana, on trains that carried them toward Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and New York. They left behind sharecropping arrangements that had changed little since slavery, Jim Crow laws that governed every public space, and a system of racial terror underwritten by state governments and enforced by lynch mobs. They moved toward wages. The steel mills of Pittsburgh were paying black workers $3 to $4 per day, more than they had earned in an entire week in the South. The stockyards and meatpacking plants of Chicago's South Side needed workers. The automobile factories of Detroit needed workers. The munitions factories that supplied the Allied war effort needed workers. And with European immigration cut off by the war, plant managers were willing, however reluctantly, to hire black men. The migration had been building since the 1890s, but it accelerated dramatically after 1915 for reasons that combined push and pull with particular intensity. The boll weevil had entered the United States.